This is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Welcome, everybody. It's Bob, Dave, and Moore here on 710 ESPN Seattle, Monday edition of the program. Coming up today, we got the Professor John Clayton, as we do every day at 5 o'clock. Pete Carroll press conference happening around 4, depending on when he decides to step
up
to
the podium. Well, yeah, it said 350 on the email.
We're talking about Pete.
Did you know, somewhere
in that neighborhood.
I've never called him on this, but...
Oh, boy. Well, I'm glad you showed restraint.
Did you read Win Forever?
No.
I read Win Forever. And one of the things that he talks about in there is about the importance of being on time. And I'm a stickler on that one because I don't like anyone else thinking that my time is more valuable than theirs. And so I always want to make sure that I'm on time or at least a little bit early. You know, I slack off on other things in life, but that's one of those things where I just want to make sure that I'm always on time. And Pete Carroll's probably on time for meetings with his players and different things with practice. But when it comes to the media... And it's no big deal. And
you take it as a sign of disrespect.
well, it's not on the Mike Leach. He would say his media thing would start at 2 o'clock and it wouldn't start till 2:30 or 2:35. And I was always thinking, well, you know, hey coach, if you're gonna start it at 2:30, why don't you just start it at 2:30? You know,
then he would start it at 2:45.
I know, but Pete's usually a little bit late. He's what do you call it? Fashionably late with the media when he gets going, and that's okay if it gets started at 3:55 or 4. And you could argue, and I'm sure somebody from the 3:60 or 4:25 would argue this, that his time is indeed more valuable than ours.
I'm going to guess you're right. The sentiment would be with the coach. Yeah. So we'll Pete Carroll expected somewhere around 4. Whenever he steps up to the podium, we'll send you out there to the VMAC. So stay tuned for that. Also, Dean Blandino will join us at 3:30. We'll talk officiating with him, see if he buys into the idea that, you know, they're calling games to favor the offense, and that's why the defenses, in a lot of cases, look down. There are some good defenses, and we can go through those later if we want. But people saying, well, that's why the Seahawks look the way they do defensively, and these other teams, they're not making the calls. They're not calling holding. And I'm thinking, really? Is that why guys are just running free all over the middle of the field there, and there's not a Seahawk in sight? They're all being held? What's going on? So we'll talk to them about that, get into all of that conversation. But what a great weekend for the Seahawks. They didn't have to lift a finger, suffer an injury, develop another bruise, and they're the best team. You could argue the best team in the NFC, the only undefeated team in the NFC at 5-0, because A, the Packers were dreadful yesterday, and somehow the 49ers beat a Rams team we all thought looked to be the most well-rounded, complete team maybe in the NFC. And then you look deeper and you go, well, I guess their wins all came against the NFC East, which is barely a professional division. So did we overestimate the Rams, underestimate the 49ers, a little of both? What do you think?
You know what's funny is in your email today you mentioned that about the Rams' wins coming against the NFC East. And so you have to mark them down a little bit for that. But all this last week, when people were talking about the Rams being the best team in the NFC, even though they had one loss, they had that loss where they were down 28-3 to Buffalo.
They probably should have won.
And they came back, and then there was a bad call when Buffalo came back again, a pass interference call that maybe shouldn't have been called. But I thought, yeah, I think people are right. Boy, look at the Rams. They're number 5 in offense, total offense, and number 4 in defense. So they're the complete team that the Seahawks maybe aren't, and maybe Green Bay the same way. Their defense, no great shakes either. But now, it's funny, week to week when you see different things and you go, well, maybe the Rams aren't quite as good as we thought. And then last week I was thinking the 49ers were done because the schedule that they have coming up here.
It's brutal.
They've got Seattle next week. And so you're just going, well, okay, the 49ers, they're not going to be able, they're probably going to go 8-8. But you watch them last night and you go, all right, well, that looks like a Super Bowl team from last year. They handled the Rams pretty easily last night. They did a great job, shut Goff down, and I was impressed with them. So it's just wacky. I mean, it's week to week. You see teams that you think are really good, other teams that are really bad, and then you change your opinion on them based on their performance that week.
And the thing about the Rams and 49ers, whether we underestimated the Niners and overestimated the Rams, doesn't really matter because they're always problematic for the Seahawks. The Rams, no matter whether they were on their way to the Super Bowl or they were on their way to a 4-win season, were always a pain in the backside for the Seahawks. So it doesn't really matter how we if we underestimated or overestimated, because you know it's going to be a tough game.
No, you're right. And last year the Rams were down, put quotes around down, because because they were compared to the year before when they went to the Super Bowl. But still, they came. Greg Zuerlein missed a 47-yarder here in Seattle that would have given them the victory. And then they handed Seattle the only road loss last year down there in L.A., and they were pretty convincing with that one.
Yeah, here's Sean McVay talking about they had some players that normally come up big for them, but they didn't in this game.
Yeah, you know, offensively, we just were never able to really get any sort of continuity. We had a lot of missed ops tonight, some decisions that clearly I've got to do a better job with. But I think as a whole, just too many things that – we're not accustomed to doing. And, you know, you give credit to the 49ers. They did a nice job, but we made a lot of things that, you know, we made a lot of uncharacteristic things. We had a lot of our players that we count on that didn't come through in some situations that they typically do. But
can we get him a throat lozenge or something?
No, I was just going to say, does that voice go with his body?
Kind of.
Does it?
Kind of, yeah.
No, I mean, if you told
kind of a firecracker voice, but it sounded a little roughed up there.
If you had just played that without telling me who it was, I wouldn't have come up with Sean McVay.
What would
that.
You have pictured? A big guy? Small guy?
Yeah, probably a bigger guy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think the Rams are going to be a problem regardless. Maybe we gave them a little too much credit based on who they'd beaten. But, again, when it comes to division play, that all's out the window. It has been and always has been. So I think they're going to be a problem. I think the 49ers will be a problem. Now, the other team, quickly, the 49ers, I thought, and we'll talk to John Clayton about this, I thought they did a great job. You got to give Kyle Shanahan a lot of credit for the game plan. They had Garoppolo throwing little dump-off passes behind the line of scrimmage. They were charting him on the game last night. Like, I can't remember what the number got to, but like he never threw past the line of scrimmage. I mean, they were protecting him. That was the ultimate game manager game for a quarterback, and it worked. You won. So I don't know if it was because, hey, we want to manage this injury. We don't want him running around. We don't want him, you know, waiting for routes to develop, and meanwhile he's going to get cream back there, so we need to get the ball out of his hands immediately. I'm not sure what the motivation was, but it was a great game plan, and here he is talking after the game.
We always have a pretty big sense of urgency, but I think when you get embarrassed like we did last week, you know, it's – and when you get embarrassed like that, you can find out a lot about your team. And, you know, we came in Monday and it was a hard day. But usually when stuff like that happens, you know, guys either give in and because it gets too hard and they try to hide and point fingers a little bit and just go through the motions, or guys try to step it up and get better. And I was very impressed with the character of our team and just some of the just how the players carried themselves and the way they came out to practice on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. And really the way they responded to all of us getting embarrassed.
Yeah. Basically opposite of the New York Jets is what he's talking about there. But I thought you got to give him credit. He's a good coach, man. He's really good. I thought the game plan was really good. Again, whatever their motivation is, I don't know if they don't trust Garoppolo to throw the ball around, you know, deep down the field.
Well, especially now coming off that injury and the way he looked against Miami.
I still think he's a middle-of-the-road quarterback, and maybe he'll prove me wrong. I don't think he's great. I don't think he's a great quarterback.
No, he's not great, but he looked good last night. He did what they needed him to do. And then you look at the 49ers, too, last night. So I sit there and I think, okay, the Rams with Aaron Donald, and they're probably pretty good against the run. It's going to be tough, even though they have Mostert back, and he seemed to be running. The 49ers just ran at will, it seemed like, at times.
Whatever they wanted.
Yeah, they did. And then you think the 49ers, even when they were trying to close the game out, the Rams had gotten within eight, you thought maybe that Goff would get the ball back and have another chance. And even when the Rams knew that the 49ers were running the ball, they were still able to do it and do it effectively and close out the game. So you're right. And don't you just love this division, though? I mean, I know if you're a Seahawks fan, you'd probably like to have, you know, some teams like the NFC East in there that you could just pound on.
You'd be like the Patriots every year beating up on the lowly teams in their division.
Beating on the Jets and then the Dolphins in years past. But, yeah, it's going to be fun. Every time there's an NFC West game, and we've got one coming up this next Sunday, finally, when the Seahawks get back into action.
Now, as far as the Packers go, I look at that game and Aaron Rodgers had gone like 156 pass attempts or something along those lines without throwing an interception. Then he throws two in three pass attempts. He throws two. I mean, it just wasn't an Aaron Rodgers day. You give Tampa Bay all the credit in the world. I don't look at that and go, ah, the Packers aren't what we thought. We overestimated the Packers. They're not that good. Aaron Rodgers isn't that. No. I think in a 16-game season, you're going to throw out a dud. That's just how it goes most of the time, right? There's just going to be that game where you go, ugh, That didn't go well. Maybe for the Seahawks, they were on the verge of it last week against the Vikings. You were going, this is a dud. Both sides of the ball, they can't do anything. It's not looking good, and they pulled it out of the fire. I don't put much into that. I don't view the Packers differently now and go, yeah.
You don't?
Not really. I think it's just the dud. Now, what surprises me is the comment from Aaron Rodgers after the game, like basically paraphrasing because I don't have it right in front of me, but, yeah, we needed this kick in the butt. We needed that. I'm thinking that implies you were complacent, just feeling really good about life and thinking you're five games into the season. How do you get complacent that early? You know, if they're 8-0, if they're 9-0 or 8-1, 9-1, somewhere along there, all right, you're deep into the season. Maybe you're getting comfortable. How do you need a kick in the butt moment this early in the season?
No, I thought the same thing. But Aaron Rodgers, I would think that that's a template that other teams can use. When you see that, boy, you get in his face, and he had issues. And I thought Stacey brought up a good point today on her show, Tom, Jake, and Stacey, about talking about Russell Wilson when he threw an interception, first play, first pass against New England, and Russell just shrugs it off, and he just comes back, and they end up winning the game. Aaron Rodgers, everything went south after he threw that first pick six. And it was a strange one too, Bob, because you were watching, everybody was watching. They controlled the first, 10 minutes of the game? They were up 10-0.
Yep.
I thought, man, you know, it looks like it's going to be one of those days for Brady and the Bucs. They're not as good as everybody's talking about. Boy, Tampa Bay, look out for them. And yet everything after that, 38 unanswered points for Tampa Bay, winning 38-10. Green Bay didn't even score after those first 10 points. It was just, it was weird to me. So I think other teams can learn something from that. And the other part of it, too, I think Tom was talking about this today, was talking about the blitz, you know, and the pressure getting to Aaron Rodgers. And Patrick Mahomes and Russell Wilson are, go ahead and take your chances if you want to blitz. And if you have a good pass rush, you know that Russell Wilson and Mahomes are still going to take advantage of you.
Yeah.
But Rodgers wasn't able to do that.
No, not really. And I'll not blame him for that second one because he hit Devontae Adams right in the head, bounced right off his hands. That was a good throw. I mean, I put that one on the receiver,
you're right.
The second interception. But ultimately, they were a team we were talking about. Those were the two teams, the Rams and the Packers, we were talking about. All right, as far as the NFC goes, that's kind of, you're shuffling those three, right? It's the Seahawks, it's the Packers, it's the Rams. Who's the best?
Doesn't it make you feel better, though? Because we sit there and wring our hands over the defense, and rightfully so, because there hasn't been. Bob Condotta wrote a story today in the Seattle Times talking about some of the historically bad defenses. And the Giants had the worst one in 2011, or one of the worst ones, and still were able to win the Super Bowl. And so we're trying to figure out if the Seahawks can get it done with this defense. And maybe this is a year that if they continue to go the way they're going, because you look at the Packers, the Rams, other teams in the NFC, Chicago, everybody's down on them, even though they're 5-1. But this might be a year where Seattle's good enough to run the table anyway. Not run the table 16-0, but get that number one seed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's set up for them, man. If they could just improve a little bit, just get a little bit better. How about not last?
Shouldn't they this week? look at everybody. They got Adams coming back. That's like getting two guys back.
Right.
Okay, Rasheem Green's coming back.
Okay.
Jordan Brooks, I'm not that excited about, but maybe you are.
I don't. He hasn't shown me anything to feel one way or the other. I'm indifferent to him. I'm curious to see him, but yeah, Snacks.
Snacks.
Hopefully he's in shape. We'll see what. Maybe it takes him a few games to get up to speed. I'm sort of reserving judgment on if he goes out there and he's only out for a handful of plays and he doesn't have an impact, I'm not going to freak out.
Do you ever listen to the Brock and Salk podcast?
The what?
The Brock and Salk podcast.
They have a podcast?
Yeah, they do. And I listen to it every week. I'm going to suck up to one of my bosses here by saying that.
You're
okay.
Good at that.
But I heard Brock talking about not really. I'm working on that part of my game. Trust me on that. No, I heard Brock talking about Snacks Harrison, though. He's not that excited about what Harrison might bring to this defense. And he had good rationale for it, because if Snacks Harrison was so good, then how come no one else was going after him? And Brock is also talking about him maybe not being quite in shape right away. We're going to have to slow play him a little bit and hope that he'll come around.
Yeah.
But
that
I like
sense.
You know, number one, I like his nickname. Number two, he's got an all-pro season on his resume.
You know what? Even if he at this point is just a journeyman average player, that's where they succeed. We talk about this all of the time.
He's got to be as good as Colin Cole or some of those other guys they brought in, right? He's got to be better than that.
They've had success with all of these guys, and none of them come in here as Pro Bowlers. Like, man, we're excited about, you know, we're excited about Tony McDaniel. We're excited about Ataba Rubin. right? We're excited about Al Woods. No, they're guys. You're going, eh, okay.
I forgot about Otabo Rubin, but he was good.
He was. All those guys were good. They all fit in. They just have a knack for these journeyman defensive tackles who come in and maybe they're a little older or they've dealt with injuries, or you just look at them and go, eh, all right.
But this guy is above all those others.
Well, his resume is. But
and he's still
maybe
not
he's
that
not
old,
that
though. He's only at 31 or 32.
Yeah, but he's a guy who was flirting with retirement, and you know, you question his desire at this point. And I'm with Brock. I don't expect anything right out of the gate in the sense of conditioning-wise. I don't know where he's going to be. But I just look at their track record, again, with all those guys. Throw Jason Jones in there. It's just one after another where they've just found these guys who are like, all right, you hear their name and you go, okay. But then within this scheme, Clinton McDonald. Another one. They all just succeed, and they all have an impact. And I look at him as a prime example of that kind of player.
Yeah, how about just even if he is on that level?
Rotational piece, but
right.
Effective.
The rotational part of it you got to like, because it's going to lessen the fatigue for the other players, and maybe they'll be more effective as a result, and maybe he'll draw a double team.
Yeah, as much as they whiff on draft picks here and there, or there are areas we look at and go, man, you're just not good at evaluating talent for this position group. They have a knack for these guys. They really do. I mean, that's a pretty lengthy list I just gave you of guys that have come in here and have been impact players. Not Pro Bowlers, not all pros. They didn't come in with all this expectation, but you talk about them, you go, yeah, Tony McDaniel was really good. Jason Jones was really good. Otabo Rubin was good. Clinton McDonald was good. Al Woods was good. None of them get you excited when you hear their name coming in here.
Wasn't McDaniel camping in Leavenworth or something like that when they got him? I think that was the story.
I can't remember, yeah.
It was something to do with Leavenworth. I remember that.
Yeah, but just guys you don't get excited about. Like, oh, he's going to come in here and be a difference maker. And they weren't. I'm not making the case they were Aaron Donald. But within the scheme and being part of that rotation, they each had an impact. They were each good for what they were being asked to do. And I put Snacks Harrison in that category. Now, he's got a better resume. But, you know, is it going to take him a couple games to get in football shape and get used to the, you know, how things
probably
are run?
Probably.
So, I don't
are they going to be better with Adams? And I know that's probably like, what a stupid question that Jim just asked, Bob, but they weren't that good with him, statistically speaking. I mean, the stats were the same basically when Adams was there than when he wasn't. So how will they use him to be more effective with him?
I think they could still give up a bunch of yards with him there, but he's capable of making those drive-changing plays, right? He can alter a drive with a sack, with a tackle for a loss, or just a big-time play where you don't really have those guys right now. It's happening here and there, obviously, the KJ interception and things like that. But I think he's got the ability, maybe at the end of the game, you go, well, they still piled up 400 yards. You're going, yeah, but that drive was snuffed out because Jamal Adams tackled that guy behind the line of scrimmage, forced him to punt, or came in with a sack, forced him to punt. That one drive could be the difference in that game, and he's that guy. He's an impact guy. I don't want to see him do anything different with him. People were saying, oh, man, you bring him up to the line of scrimmage, you have him rushing the passer, you're leaving the middle of the field wide open. That's why the yards are what they are. Well, no, because it was that way when he was not there. It was that way when he was there. So I would say put him in the position to make a game-changing play, a drive-changing play. Let him continue to be that guy.
Do you want him to blitz more?
I want him to do exactly what they've been doing based on the opponent. I think that's how they've been doing it, looking at the quarterback, looking at the offensive line, going, okay, here's how we can use Jamal. I want him to continue to move him all around. I don't want him, I saw, and again, it was very few, but people saying he needs to be more of a traditional safety. You got to use him in a more traditional way. No, I don't want to see that.
Then
you
lose his strengths.
Yeah, he's an impact guy.
Yeah.
One of the few on that defense, if we're being honest.
Well, yeah. Well, hopefully, too. These guys haven't played together that much. I mean, we talked about them being possibly at least comparable to the Legion of Boom, and understanding that the Legion of Boom is way up there, but you could at least put them in the, not the same sentence, but the same paragraph when you talk about, boy, this might be the best secondary they've had since the Legion of Boom, and it's been anything but. But now maybe when they have more time together, Quentin Dunbar being healthy, Shaquille Griffin, a lot of people think he's having a good season. He's got two interceptions.
A lot of people doesn't include you.
A lot of people. John Clayton thinks that he should be franchise tagged at the end of the season.
You're not part of a lot of people.
But it's only five games in. We'll see how it goes the rest of the way. And then Quandre Diggs on the back end. So hopefully again, the defense won't get worse. And so there's potential there for it to get better.
Yeah, I think with everybody coming in, they'll get better. How much better? I think it's going to be marginal. I don't expect them to go from 32nd to 15th, I think it'll be, you know, game by game. Hopefully you'll see a progression. That's what I'm hoping. We'll see just a little bit better against the Cardinals, and then 49ers after that, I think.
49ers right? after that
yeah,
here in
Seattle.
A little
bit better. Just start working your way up instead of, you know, residing in the basement the way they are.
Well, yeah, Condotta noted that when New York, the Giants, when they won the Super Bowl, they were 25th in points allowed and 27th in yards allowed.
Yeah.
So just get in that neighborhood.
That'd be fine.
Get out of the 30s first.
32nd is no good. Let's take two.
It's time to take two. Brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
Take two.
The Dodgers and Rays will face each other in the World Series. After much to Bob's delight, the Astros could not defeat the Rays Saturday to advance.
What? The Astros aren't there?
No, Bob.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Houston, what happened?
Were you happy?
Yeah, I was really happy.
Yeah.
I was nervous because all of the momentum was with Houston, right? They were facing a sweep. They were down 3-0. They win 3 in a row. I'm thinking, oh, geez, man, we're looking at the Red Sox Yankees again. Here we go. We're going to have to hear about how much heart they had, the heart of a champion. They never quit, and they came back to fight their way to the World Series, winning 4 in a row. Everything was on their side. And, yeah, it was just delightful to see them lose that final game.
You like seeing Mike Zunino in there?
Yes.
Doing the post-game interview?
He mashed that home run in that game. Mashed it.
I got a kick out of Salk. I'll rip him now, even though I was sucking up to him earlier. he was saying when he had his 12:30 spot with Tom, Jake, and Stacy that you know he gets tired of Mariner fans always rooting for former Mariners, and he's rooting against Mike Zunino.
Is he really?
How can anyone who's living, breathing baseball fan here in Seattle honestly be rooting against Mike Zunino?
They might ask you the same question about Chris Taylor.
Oh, well. Because Chris Taylor was it's not like Zunino's tearing up the world down there in Tampa Bay. He's still not that good. He comes up with the occasional home run. We saw that here in Seattle. He'll strike out a lot in the series, too.
He was hitting under 200 here.
He was hit, yeah, and he only hit 147 for the Rays this year.
So
and I'm a hypocrite. I'm a hypocrite. I don't know why I think, you know, sometimes. But Chris Taylor, I won't be pulling for him.
All right.
Minnesota sports writer Sid Hartman passed this weekend at the age of 100. He covered sports for the Star Tribune for 75 years and was still contributing 3 to 4 columns a week, with his last column being published on the day that he passed.
Wow.
Pretty cool. I never crossed paths with him, and I wish I had. I was going to – we'll ask Leighton a question about him. But, yeah, Sid Hartman, I read about Peter King, Football Morning in America, wrote a little thing about Sid Hartman and talked about how he had another sports writer helping him with doing interviews, and he filed his last column on Thursday. He talked to Adam Thielen about how the Vikings maybe were going to turn it around, and I can't believe that he just kept going to the age of 100.
Worked for them for 75 years. 75 years for the Star Tribune, man. Good for him. I'd heard his name a million times. I don't think I ever had a chance to speak with him. Maybe. I don't recall if I did.
No, I never did, but
certainly heard his name. And
it's just incredible that he worked that long, lived to the age of 100. And so to put it in terms for myself, Bob, that I'll still be sitting here in the year 2057 talking about the Seahawks.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Do you think you'd be more glass half full or empty at that point? What do you think?
No, I think the glass will still be half empty, Bob.
Okay. All right. Coming up, we're going to catch up with Dean Blandino and get his thoughts on the impact of officiating and if that's the cause for this historic start to the season for offenses out there, defenses struggling. We'll get his take coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Well, we've talked a lot about the offenses and the defenses and how the offenses are way ahead. Defense is struggling, certainly in the case of the Seahawks. And many point to the way the games are being officiated these days and saying, well, that's why. Well, let's get to the bottom of that. A man who knows a thing or two about the rules and how things are being officiated, Dean Blandino, Fox Sports rules analyst and former NFL VP of officiating, also head of officiating for the XFL. Look at how about that for credentials, Dean? You know everything. You've got it all. How are
you?
Yeah,
I know a couple things about officiating. Maybe that might be my wheelhouse, though.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, because that seems to be, you know, we're still early into the season, but a lot of people pointing to the way the games are being officiated, that it's sure. set up even more for the offense. They're not calling holding. They're not calling this, that, or the other, and offenses are just running amok out there. What do you say to that?
Well, I think all fouls are down across the board. If you look at the numbers, you know, going into tonight's games, roughly 13.5 fouls per game compared to 18.5 last year. So 5 fouls per game. That's a drastic drop. And the game didn't, you know, players didn't miraculously stop fouling. And but when you look at it and you start to break it down, offensive holding does jump out as one of the prime suspects where we have a real decrease in offensive holding. And certainly that will lend itself to offenses, you know, moving the ball. The rushing yards per game are way up. Scoring is up. And you would think that those aren't bad things. And maybe on the surface they aren't. But if you're not calling fouls, you know, the rules are there to allow the players to decide the game with their skills, not by, you know, gaining an advantage illegally. And I think that's part of the concern if this continues.
Well, Dean, have you seen a lot of holding calls that haven't been called that would have been called last year? Because I imagine they're all over the place.
Well, yeah, you know, you watch a game and you definitely, obviously, I look at the game just from my experience looking at it from a different lens, and it does jump out when you see something, and I find myself, you know, yelling at the TV screen that's a hold. And there's no question that, like I said, you know, offensive linemen didn't stop holding. We're just calling it less. And if that means the standard has changed, then the league has to look at the rule book and make those modifications in the rule book and let everybody know that the standard has changed, because it's, you know, that's where everything comes from, the rule book and the competition committee and things like that.
Well, did the standard change because fans got tired of seeing so many yellow flags?
Well, look, part of it is maintaining a consistent pace and flow of the game. There's no question penalties do obviously interrupt the game. And it's frustrating to watch a game where there's 25, 30 fouls. But the reality is it's not in an ideal world, it's not the officials who decide how many fouls there are. It's the two teams. And if you do let teams get away with penalties, then someone's going to gain an advantage. Teams are going to take advantage of that. Players are going to get, you know, they understand where the bar is and they're going to play to that bar. And I think that's, again, part of the concern, you know, going forward.
I mean, offense is exciting, and people want to see offense, and I think people are always fearful that it's going to be too extreme one way or the other. I remember the Chiefs-Rams game from a couple of years ago. Everybody freaked out, said, oh, great, this is what football is going to look like now, you know, touch football, and it's going to be 52-47 every week, which was a massive overreaction. You can look at teams like the Ravens allowing 17 points a game, the Steelers 18 points a game, the Dolphins 18 points a game. I mean, some defenses are finding success here. Is it just that they're not calling, they're calling more penalties when those teams are playing versus the others? I feel like on some level, Dean, it's a convenient excuse for some defenses that just frankly aren't that great.
Yeah, no question. And the thing is, when you look at these penalties, it's not about just, you know, not calling fouls and the offenses are going to thrive. It's about that balance, like you said. And what made that Chiefs-Rams game, right, that was exciting because, you know, not every game is like that. You look at some college conferences and when it's just a track meet and there's no drama, right? The offense is going to get the ball. They're going to drive. The other team's going to get the ball. They're going to drive, and it's going to be 62-56. That, if that becomes the norm, that's not exciting anymore, right? You have to have that balance. You have to have the idea that the defense can make a stop. And like you said, right, teams like the Steelers, the Ravens, they've got it figured out. Those are historically good defensive teams, and those teams are going to continue to do well on that side of the ball. But so it is an excuse to some extent, but it does have an impact on the game if this continues for longer than, you know, 5-6 week window. If this continues for a season, two seasons, that changes the game.
Hey, Dean, when the red challenge flag comes out, everybody's sitting at home, tries to figure out whether it was a good call, whether they're going to reverse it. You have any idea what you're – I mean, you're on the line there. You're doing the games for Fox.
Sure.
How's your batting percentage on that?
Well, I like to think that I'm batting 1,000, and when we don't agree, that they're wrong, not me. But but it's hard because, and I went through this when I was at the NFL and I was making decisions in the command center in New York, is sometimes you may see something and to you it's obvious, but to the millions of people watching the game at home or the 80,000 people in the stadium when we could have fans, it's not that obvious. And that's where you kind of go back to, okay, if it's not obvious, then the ruling on the field has to stand. And I think that's part of the challenge with replay, is just understanding that standard and not being overly technical. And that's part of the process.
Which call gets called the most that's wrong, in your opinion? I always sit there. I'm not quite sure on pass interference anymore, but I assume you probably are.
Well, sometimes it's, I think offensive pass interference, if you look at the numbers, and the league evaluates all of their officials and they grade them, and there's things, you know, incorrect calls and a no call when a foul should have been called and it wasn't. And I think offensive pass interference always, and defensive pass interference always, is kind of high on that list in terms of mistakes or debatable calls. Offensive holding, just because the opportunity for that is so great. Every play, there's an opportunity for holding with the close line play. But definitely pass interference, it's so subjective. We saw that play out last year, right, when it went to replay review. It was a moving target throughout. And so definitely offensive pass interference is probably up there, defensive right behind it.
So, Dean, if you were going to rate the product right now, what would give it a grade? What would it be? Because I'm looking at it going, I don't really see a massive difference. I guess the numbers tell a story, but when I'm watching the game, I'm not sitting there as a fan going, how come there are no flags being thrown? That's holding. That's all. I haven't really had that feeling. I'd give it an A-. I'd give it a, you know, somewhere up there. But what would you grade it?
Yeah, I think, look, I, based on everything that has happened, right, without having an off season where you have your normal routine where you can get together and go to training camp and mini camp and clinics and things like that, I think the officials are doing a great job. And certainly I'm looking at it from a more critical eye than somebody that hasn't had the officiating experience and background. So I think they're doing a great job. And again, it's just, I've always looked at the game from the health of the game and people, you know, with penalties historically, your average is between 15 and 16 a game. And that kind of keeps the game under control. It allows the offense and defense to have that balance. And whenever it dips below that drastically, or it goes above that drastically, it just gets on my radar and it's something just to watch for, you know, long term, not in a short 5 or 6 week window.
Dean Blandino of Fox Sports, their rules analyst, former NFL VP of officiating, has been our guest here. Dean, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for taking time with us. Enjoy the rest of the season. I'm sure we'll catch up again.
You got it. Thanks for having me, guys.
Good stuff from Dean Blandino. Coming up, we touched on this earlier, but can the Seahawks win the Super Bowl with this defense as it is right now? We'll break down some of the past defenses that made it and discuss where they could still improve. That's coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
A reminder, you've got radios in your homes. If you've got a smart speaker, just tell it to play 710 ESPN Seattle or 710 AM. It becomes a radio right there. Very easy. Coming up at the top of the hour, the head coach, Pete Carroll, will be stepping up to the podium. We'll send you out to the VMAC as soon as he's available coming up. But this defense, and Jim, we touched on this briefly, that we look at this defense and go, my goodness, the yards are terrible. And you get people texting and going, well, yards don't beat you. Well, they have a way of beating you because your defense is on the field forever, right? We saw it what was almost a 20-minute differential in time of possession in the last game. They were able to get away with it, but that's when you go, yeah, that's not sustainable.
Boy, I saw that 4th-and-inches play again last night. Yeah. And, boy, if the running back, Madison, if he just goes a little more to the right.
He gets it.
He goes into the – not only gets a first down, he goes into the end zone untouched.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's it's not a, it doesn't always lead to a score, but what it leads to is less time for your offense, and your defense is on the field for a long time. So never good. But you were looking at some notes from Bob Condotta and everything that gave you a little bit of hope as to what could be in front of the Seahawks.
Yeah, and Bob has a mailbag every week, and he does a great job covering the team for the Seattle Times. But yeah, he mentioned, and we talked about this before too, and in 2018, Kansas City had the worst defense in the league and didn't quite make it. They lost to New England in the AFC Championship game. But then last year, they were 17th in total yards allowed, 349.6. Now you look at that, though, and you're going, well, the Seahawks are at 471 right now, so it's another 120 yards that the Seahawks are allowing. And you just hope, and like we're talking about here, you're not really wanting the Seahawks to be the 2013 defense because that's unrealistic. Just be someone that's in the teens like Kansas City or someone like the New York Giants. Condotta also noted they won the Super Bowl with – they're the team that won with the worst defense over the years. And the Giants were 25th in points allowed, and they were 27th in yards allowed. And – still, they were 376 yards allowed, and the Seahawks at 471. So you just want to see it start coming down. I mean, everybody does, but you know, even if they got it down to 450 a game, and then 425, and then 400, and then shoot for 390, yeah. And
just trend the
so
right
on.
Direction.
And part of that, though, and Bob noted this too, that the teams are averaging 15 yards more a game this year and scoring 2.3 points more per game. And we just talked to Dean Blandino, and the lack of offensive holding calls have contributed to that. So there are different factors that are favoring the offense. So we're seeing higher scoring games. And Clayton talks about that all the time, too. You just want, yeah, again, just get a little better. And it they should.
Yeah, they should. Based on look at the roster, you look at the talent and say, oh, there's no reason for them to be in the cellar. Nobody's trying to make the case that they should be the Legion of Boom part two. And nobody's under that illusion. But I think it's fair to hope that they could be mediocre. That's a fair expectation based on the amount of money being devoted to that side of the ball, the commitment to guys like Wagner, to guys like K.J. Wright, Jamal Adams. I mean, you've invested in the defense. I think a mediocre defense is a fair expectation. And here's Pete talking about feels like they were turning the corner on defense after the Vikings game.
Yeah, we had our best night on third down. You know, we were 40-something, you know, which was – that's a move in the right direction. The turnovers are huge for us, yeah. But really the third down stops are really where we have to continue to work on. Points are down the last couple of weeks. I know it's not a major difference, but we're transitioning, and we are changing right now, and it's good.
Are they? They gave up over 200 on the ground to the Vikings, and I mean, I guess you can cherry pick, you know, well, this stat was a lot better, or, you know, third down was a lot better, and we're trending down. They allowed 26 points to the Vikings. They allowed 31 the week before to the Dolphins.
Well, it's okay, I was just thinking about Jacksonville, and we know that the Jaguars have one of the worst defenses in the league, and you can, if you're a Jacksonville fan, you're down there going, yeah, well, we got rid of Jalen Ramsey, and we got rid of Ngakoue, and looked like the team was, you know, tanking for Lawrence, and you know, all these different things where you could rationalize it and go, well, okay, I understand why the Jaguars' defense isn't that good. But in Seattle, it's hard to do any rationalizing, especially when you have, as you mentioned, Bobby Wagner, K.J. Wright. I mean, you just go down the list.
Yeah, Jamal
Jared
Adams,
Reed, all the guys in the second.
Diggs,
everyone
Quentin
in the
Dunbar.
Secondary you yeah. seem to like. And I always sit there and I go, well, yeah, I kind of like those guys too, but probably not as much as everybody else does. And if they're that good, then how come they're not stopping people? That's why, like, when people talk about Shaquille Griffin getting franchise tagged, I'm going, really? And then, well, like Clayton goes, well, Jim, who do you have behind him? And I go, well, I don't know. And so maybe I guess, but would you pay Shaquille Griffin $14 million? I'd have to swallow really hard before I, if I'm Schneider, and go, yeah, well, here you go, Shaquille.
Yeah.
Because he's part of a pass defense that's the worst in the league. I mean, they're averaging 370 yards against. Now, and you get kind of tired of the excuses after a while. Well, Seattle's way ahead, and so teams are coming back, and you're playing looser. But I heard Michael Sean Dugar last night with Paul Silvey talking about, yeah, but teams are – well, he wrote for The Athletic today talking about it. Teams are one-dimensional mm-hmm. at that point in the game. So you should be able to pin your ears back like they talk about and get after the quarterback, and you shouldn't be giving up as many yards when you know they're going to pass.
And it's also not entirely true, as we've talked about, the Falcons game where they were, it was a 14-12 game at the half. They'd given up 240 yards. The Vikings game, they were down 13-0 at the half. It wasn't the Vikings, you know, throwing it all over to come back. They had the lead. You were being shut out after the first half. So
that's why I always come back to coaching. I mean, to me, I just look at it and go, well, it seems pretty simple that they've got individual players who are pretty talented, according to most people, and they're not getting it done collectively.
All right. We'll see what Pete Carroll has to say about things in the bye week. He'll be stepping up to the podium momentarily. We'll send you out there. Coming up with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.